It is said that no mindfulness is ever wasted. No moment of mindfulness is ever wasted. It's also said that mindfulness is always good. A little bit reassuring if you give those statements the benefit of the doubt. But I've come to believe this, that no amount of mindfulness is ever wasted. So we sit here and we're mindful, and all kinds of things happen, and we're mindful. We sit some more, and all kinds of things happen, and we're mindful. And the comings and goings of things, and the ups and downs, it might seem that the mindfulness that you had an hour ago, 5 minutes ago, that's long gone. But it's accumulative, it builds, it has kind of, in this subways of the mind, the heart, it has a tremendous value, what we're building and doing here. No amount of mindfulness is ever wasted. And we might not know in the moment or in the hour and in the day how it's beneficial for us. And to always be looking, you know, measuring moment by moment is not so useful. I know when I was a new practitioner, I measured the total worth and value and success of my practice just about every minute. You know, so am I there yet? Have I arrived? Is this what it's supposed to be? Is this, you know? And it just seemed like what was happening in the moment, you know, was like the measure or the place to evaluate what was going on. And I kind of made myself miserable that way. Much later, I heard the analogy of a farmer who's growing corn, and the corn seeds sprout, and there's little sprouts coming out of the ground. And the farmer wants to see how well it's growing, so comes and pulls the seeds out of the ground. And yeah, it's growing. But you can't really transplant corn seedlings very well or put them back. So it's like, yeah, they were growing well. But so to be watching, you know, watching. You know, now, is it now? Is it what's, you know, is this it or something? And after, for me, a few years of practice, I developed the idea that I didn't have to evaluate and judge what's happening every moment, and to expect that there be all kinds of ups and downs, that the path is not linear from worse to better and better and better, but rather it undulates and comes and goes, and sometimes it's practice is difficult, and sometimes it's easy, and sometimes, it predictably, the difficulty follows the easy times. And, you know, it goes on and on. And after a while, there was a contentment to just practice, trust the practice, trust just showing up and being there, and not having to measure or figure out or fix everything that's happening, but you kind of ride, or be constant in the practice to a certain degree. Have a constancy of steadiness that goes through all the ups and downs, all the easy times and difficult times, not measuring or making grand conclusions. I had, you know, I made some really grand conclusions in my practice when I was young, like, I can't do this. This is impossible, and everyone who does it is crazy. But then an hour later or the next day, it's like, everyone should do this, and this is like the best, and I should go stand on the street corner and get all my friends to come, and this, because this is, don't they know how important this is? And then the next day, it's like, what was I thinking? And, you know, so it goes. But so these grand conclusions. So I stopped making grand conclusions and just kind of was much more willing to just show up and be mindful here and mindful here for this. And This quality of persistence, of steady persistence, just doing the practice, is one aspect of patience, which is the next of the paramitas. And that's how it's usually called in English. It's called patience. But the Pali word kanti, or kshanti in Sanskrit, as is true for a number of these kind of practice words, is much richer in the original language and the people had it. It's almost like patience is a it's like a, the word patience is kind of like a poor cousin of what kanti might be, or it's like a shadow of what kanti is. It has a richness and a depth and a connotations that are kind of, I don't know how to say it. You have to almost kind of live in the original text to kind of get a sense of this thing, kanti. And it means much more than just patience. There is this idea, there's really three, five different meanings for kanti. And you go, if you go in some of the, Pali English dictionaries, you see all these different meanings and different circumstances. And one of them, it means steady persistence. Persistence, just you keep doing it, keep going, step by step, step by step. One of the principles of Dharma practice, of mindfulness, is that mindfulness doesn't work at all unless you do it. And so you keep doing it and doing it and doing it. And I've kind of, there have been a few times in my years of practice where I decided it wasn't working and I stopped practicing, just on the retreat that I was in for a while, like, oh. And then I would look and say, yeah, sure, it's not working. I wasn't practicing anymore. I was maybe complaining about it, or I was busy giving up. And the steady, just doing. And there's something about the steady persistence that's very powerful. Just do it. Next step. Just take the next step. And I know the other thing I've done is looked ahead at what I thought was supposed to happen, bring with me the baggage of all kinds of things that I learned about what can happen in practice, and it just seems so complicated, and how do I get there, and what am I supposed to do with all this that's going on now? And then I don't have to figure it out. All I have to do is take a next step. And the next step in mindfulness is the most simple moment of recognition of what's happening that you could ever imagine doing. Oh, this is what's happening. And one of the great labels that I had for myself, that can be great because it really helped me, it kind of like, when I, nothing else, every, all other kind of recognitions failed. My label was, for the experience, was chaos. Just, it's chaos. And that kind of encompassed so wide, because I didn't know what was going on. It was just confusing. It was kind of chaotic, and it was all stuff happening, and didn't even know how to practice in the middle of it. And then I'd say, oh, it's chaos. It's just chaos. Just chaos. And because I've been trying to get into the middle of it and try to tease it apart and trying to, I had ideas of what I was supposed to do with it. And once I saw, oh, just chaos, then I could relax, just settle back. Just chaos. That was the next step. And then I'd probably have to recognize that again. And then as I stepped back and just saw chaos, then I said, well, chaos involves a lot of swirling energies all through my body. And now it's not as chaotic, because now I'm it's, you know, swirling energies in my body. Yes, and there's a lot of thoughts that are spinning and cycling through. And oh, thoughts, lots of energy and thoughts. So there's not this whole universe of chaos anymore, but it's just, it's, oh, this is what it is, this is what it is. It kind of showed itself as I settled back. But the idea is the next step, the simplest possible next step. Oh, it's like this. It's like this. So steady persistence is one of the meanings of this Kanti. Another meaning of Kanti is patient endurance under insult. And I kind of like the idea that the insult here is not only what people, how people might insult us, or, you know, do things to us, but also some people have this idea that our cherished attachments, especially our cherished attachments to our self-identity and who I am and need to prove myself to be, it all too easily gets insulted by reality. You know, reality doesn't care about, you know, exactly your ideas of who, what's supposed to happen and who you are and your attachments. And so there you are, you know, you and reality. Who's going to win? The idea that I have to be this way forever, forever young. Reality has other ideas for you. So you can, you know. You know, good luck. You know, it's kind of insulting what the, you know, it's kind of insulting what reality does to us as we age. That too. So, but anyway, there are, you know, there's also things people do that are quite painful and insulting, and this patient endurance under insult. The primary meaning it is, in this Buddhist tradition at least, is to not succumb to hostility. No matter what happens, refrain from hostility. And so, if it, you know, if your ongoing insults are happening, your ongoing ways in which we're challenged by things and people and all kinds of things, the Buddhist tradition puts such high value on the importance of no hostility. And I believe the primary reason for it is not for the sake of the other person, but for the sake for oneself. It causes so much harm on oneself to get involved in hostility that, and that, you know, they talk about creating bad karma, but there's so much harm on oneself that it's really important to at least be able to endure, to not give in to the hostility. It doesn't mean that you patiently sit there and, you know, and, you know, willingly just accept the insult after insult after insult. It might be that you say stop, or you do something, or intervene, or do something. But the idea is we don't give in to hostility. It's a tall order to do that. But it is a kind of restraint. Kind of, I'm not going to give in to it. I'm not going to act on it. No matter what, I'm going to keep that to myself in this situation, not let it spill out. So that's another meaning of Kanti. Still another meaning of Kanti is forgiveness. And you can, a little bit related to this, forgiveness in a kind of karmic religions of Buddhism is a little bit different than I forgive someone or someone else forgives me, because there is no forgiving of karma. Everyone kind of has to kind of play out their own karma. But there is the release of resentment, the release of anger. And in the Buddhist context, forgiveness has a lot to do with the release of the anger or the resentment that might exist, and opening the heart again with goodwill, having goodwill for someone. And those two steps are kind of the Buddhist idea of forgiveness. So this kanti, this word kanti, has this quality of that transformation, so there is some kind of forgiveness that goes on. The fourth meaning, the fourth meaning of kanti is willingness or receptivity, to be receptive to what is, to have the ability to sit and be receptive to the changing nature of our life, be receptive to the changing nature of our inner life experience and what's happening, to not be resisting, not be clinging, not be pushing, not be demanding, but to have a kind of willingness to be receptive, open to what's happening. And so, maybe this word allowing gets close to the idea of this willingness or receptivity. And then the final meaning of kanti that I know of speaks about is a bridge, or that moves into the next parami. After patience, the next parami is truth. And the way the bridge between this is kanti also means the patient's acceptance of the truth, or the patient receptivity of the truth. But it's certain, and sometimes the truth is difficult to accept. And some people, even some of the deeper insights that come with this practice, sometimes people have trouble. It can be disorienting and challenging to see, for example, how impermanent things are, or see how there's a certain kind of emptiness of substance to many of the ideas that we live under and live with. And it can be frightening or disorienting to see that many of the ways we operate in the world are projections. We project onto the world that it's substantial. We project a certain degree of values, certainly bias and judgments. We project ideas of permanence, all kinds of things that we... And this idea that impermanence is, really confronted is not an easy thing, was represented a little bit by a wonderful, delightful little story that I was told recently. It's a little bit, not quite to the point of the talk, but you'll have patience, acceptance, hopefully. And a friend of mine had gone to study with Thich Nhat Hanh in the 1980s in France. And he would spend two summers there. And Thich Nhat Hanh had a wonderful way of including children as part of the whole Dharma scene. And the children would often be put in the middle when there were the gatherings, and Thich Nhat Hanh was going to give teachings, and the kids would be in the middle and be part of it all. But one day, my friend said, that there was going to be a meeting of just the adults with Thich Nhat Hanh. So they would get talking the Dharma, and their topic was impermanence. And some of the adults were having trouble with this concept of impermanence. And so then at some point, because this kid thought it was his home, like he was always invited in, he wandered into the middle of this gathering of adults talking about impermanence. And I guess Thich Nhat Hanh invited him to sit in front, or he just thought that was his place, since that's where kids usually are. And so Thich Nhat Hanh turned to the kid and said, "We're here talking about impermanence, and some of these adults are having a hard time with this concept. Do you have anything you want to say?" I think it was an eight-year-old kid. And the kid said, "Oh, impermanence is great, because it's because of impermanence that I'm going to grow up." I thought that was kind of fun. he didn't know what happens in the other end of life. So the patient's acceptance of truth. The word for truth is satcha, S-A-C-C-A. And it also has the meaning in Pali of real or reality. So it's not just, it's not like a propositional truth that, you know, some statement of truth, but it's what is true when we have insight into reality. It's kind of the nature of reality itself is the core satcha that we have, to be in touch with and in contact with what's real. And it's quite a wonderful thing to really feel that we're here, connected and grounded in what's real and present. I had a Zen teacher who, now more than 50 years ago, was in college and was an athlete, which was important for the story, I think. And in college was introduced to Zen meditation, some kind of Zen, some event in the college. And sometimes, as this can happen with some athletes, their muscles are so tight and that to sit on the cross-legged is very, very difficult. This way. And that was his case. And so he sat down and you had to sit for, I think, 40 minutes or something. And it was excruciatingly painful for him. And he stuck it out and that sold him on Zen. That he committed. And the reason for it, he was sold in it, but with all his pain, wasn't because he was a masochist, because he said that was the first time he was real, first time he connected with what was real in life. He had spent so much time living in his thoughts, ideas, imaginations, kind of disconnected from what's real, what's here, that even though it was so painful, and it was maybe unfortunate, it was through pain that he had to encounter something that was not his imagination, he saw the value of it, and off he went to become his. And then some many years later, I was his student, and I noticed that I also sometimes had a lot of pain in my legs sitting this Zen meditation thing. And I noticed that if I sat with the pain, didn't move, I could get pretty concentrated. So I went to him and I said, I told him that. And I said, so should I, like when I sit down to do Zen meditation, should I just put myself into full lotus every time so I can have pain and have, you know, really get concentrated? And he said, no. Don't go looking for pain. Don't go making pain. Just do your practice. But when the pain comes to you, then sit with it. Be with it and let it be part of your practice. So I thought that was nice advice. It saved a lot of grief probably. So this idea of contacting reality and what is real is the opposite from when we live in the worlds of projections. And we live in a lot of projections. Some of them are innocent, and some of them are not so innocent. And we're sitting in what we call a meditation hall, and you know, you might be here someday, the first day of a retreat, and someone's never been here, and you'll say, I've been here before, let me show you where the meditation hall is. Let me show you the meditation hall. And you bring them up here, and they look around, and they see the meditation hall. And so, and then because we have a meditation hall, that idea, we project it on here, and we kind of collective projection, then we treat it a certain way. And but this, you know, it's a nice room. It could be a dance hall. In fact, it has been used as a dance hall in our times. And it could also be used for, it could be movie night. It could be a movie theater. It could be a sewing room. Could be a conference center, could be a lot of different things. It's this, the room, meditation hall is not inherent in this room. Meditation hall is a thought, an idea, a concept, which we share, hopefully. We've agreed to share this concept because we find it useful for now. and we project it onto this room. It's innocent enough. And then we walk around the retreat center, and occasionally we'll have ideas about the people who are here. And we project ideas on people. We have ideas of what, how they should be or how they shouldn't be, or we have ideas of who they are, and, you know, their background. And I had a wonderful projection when I was at the three-month retreat at IMS. And it was wonderful. I just kind of, the results were wonderful. I had a Vipassana romance with a woman who was there. So and 3 months is a long time to have a romance. You know, a lot can happen in 3 months. And in my mind, my imagination, I met her, we started seeing each other, got serious, got married, and got divorced. You know, it's kind of, you know, I wasn't like doing all the time, but 3 months, you know, you kind of, the thoughts would, you know, creep in. And so then at the end of 3 months, we were breaking silence. And so we kind of group kind of breaking silence. I think she raised her hand to ask a question. And she had this really thick French accent. And it was like the balloon just popped. The whole projection had to do with her being from the United States, being American. You know, and I realized that moment I had no idea who this person was. I had been living 3 months of projection onto this person. And that was kind of humbling to see, you know, what my mind was capable of doing and how I was painting this person with ideas and concepts and all kinds of things. So one of the concepts that we project onto the world is the idea of permanence or constancy. And it's maybe not the ultimate impermanence, forever impermanence, but I've had the occasions where, you know, I know that things are not forever and things will change. But my emotions don't know that. And so my emotionally, I kind of react to what's happening as if this is forever. I call it my delusion of permanence. And one of the great times where I saw this was when my first son was maybe a year, some months old. It was a difficult day with him, boy. And at some point, my wife and I were doing something with him, kind of hovering over him or something. And I was thinking, oh, this, what have I signed up for? This is forever. You know, that was the feeling I had. And my wife looked at me and said, "We're having one of those days." And that was all it took to pop that delusion of permanence. Oh, it's just a day, just like this. And so it's easy to have ideas that, oh, this is how it's going to be. This is how it's going to be forever. And one of the consequences of that kind of way of projection is that we often miss a lot. We miss a lot of the other things going on. So, for example, I'm going to be sad forever. But if you pay careful attention to what's happening moment by moment, certainly there's sadness, but in between there are like cracks and movements. Oh, there's a little bird that pops along the fence, and wow, look at that, it's kind of cool for a moment. The whole mind for a moment is freed of sadness. But my idea is that I'm so sad that I don't, you know, by the time I come around into my own self-projections, the sadness, the idea that I'm sad is still there, so I didn't notice there was a gap in that little moment. there's often a lot of little gaps. There's often a lot of different things coming in. And what happens if you start it starts breaking up a little bit, the projections, the ideas, the concepts, and we start seeing actually they actually come and go. They might, certain ones might predominate, but they're actually not there all the time. Sometimes it's disconcerting because some people really would like to hold on to these ideas, and whatever their ideas of self are, and they don't want to give it up so easily. Sometimes even painful states are so familiar and so habitual that it's more comforting to have them than to not have them. And so this patience, acceptance of the truth can be quite hard. Things are actually changing a lot, much more than I realize, and things are coming and going. There's the projection of then of self, ideas of self. This is who I am. This is who other people are. And they're kind of arising out of a virtual reality of thoughts, ideas. Some of them are handed to us by our society, and sometimes it can be quite painless that we take on some of these. When I was in seventh grade, I had an art teacher who came over to me, looked over my shoulder at the drawing I was doing in class, and said to me, "Gil, you have no artistic ability." I didn't care if I had artistic ability or not, but that was the authority. So I just, okay, I have no artistic ability. That's the kind of person I am. I mean, when I became an adult, I thought that was a crazy thing for this person to say, a teacher to say that, an art teacher to say. So it didn't bother me. I just thought, okay, that's how it is. And then in college, my first roommate, was probably the closest thing to a born-again artist that you could probably find. And he kind of tricked me, or you know, into doing art. And it turned out I had some little bit of talent. And then more importantly, I enjoyed it. And so I spent, you know, a number of years there never thinking about art. So it can be innocent, these ideas that we get to take from others. But some of the projections and ideas that come from outside are very painful, very contracting and limiting, where people say you're less than, you're not important, something's wrong with you. Or sometimes it comes from parents. I hear stories of parents who sometimes, what they say to their kids are just astounding, and the kids internalize it. Teachers, society. And, and I think many people in our society our society as a whole is still trying to come to terms with some of the ways in which we project values on some people, and undervalue or undercut the value of people, and it's quite painful. And then we do it for ourselves, to ourselves, for some reason. You know, we have ideas of how valuable I am. I'm not so valuable. I don't count. I shouldn't be here. It's a mistake. Or then there's the opposite extreme. You know, I'm the best. I'm fantastic. I'm wonderful. And I deserve to be recognized this way. And we had for a while in certain subcultures of our culture, for a while, the self-esteem movement, and where teachers and parents thought it was really important to have kids who had a lot of self-esteem. And that seemed, from what I've read and the studies of it, that seemed to have been a disaster. And because what they came to think that they were really special and they shouldn't have to work. And college, when some of these kids came into college, they didn't think that they had to work in order to make it through college, because they'd been told that they were wonderful and, just all propped up. Oh, you're great, you're great, you're great. So when my kid was young, I tried not to say anything to him about, oh, what a good boy. Like if he did something, oh, good boy, or something. that was kind of an instinct for me to, or a habit to kind of just want to say that, something like that. And what I learned to say or try to say was, wow, I'd get excited. Wow, you had fun doing that. Wow, that was pretty cool. That was wonderful that you were as engaged in that, whatever you did. So it was more like sharing and participating in his engagement rather than this value of what kind of person he is because of what he did. Because if I said, you're a good boy, well, then he becomes a good boy because he made some finger painting. You know, and so then if he wants to keep being a good boy, he had better keep doing finger painting. So something like that. So we sit here, mindful. No amount of mindfulness is ever wasted. And we try to stay present. Try to stay with the breathing. Get real with the breath, the reality of our direct experience. Comings and goings of the breath, of the experience, body sensations, sounds, trying to stay present. And inevitably, the mind will wander off. And that's not a mistake, that's what the mind does. Or the mind will start judging or projecting, having ideas. And part of the function of having something like the breathing to stay with is to highlight when the mind is not there. So rather than thinking you made a mistake by wandering off, the practice is designed to help you see how much the mind goes into these thoughts and ideas that happen there. If you never restrain your mind in any way whatsoever, and just let your mind kind of do whatever it wants, then you might not see what your mind is doing. You might not see the addictive quality or the compulsion around thoughts and ideas. But to kind of bump up against, you know, what we're actually doing and start seeing what we're doing takes a reference point. We have to help see something. And the analogy that I like is that of, I was up here in the Santa Cruz Mountains many years ago teaching. And there was a very clear creek, very clear shallow water. And I looked down at the water and I couldn't tell if it was flowing. So I took a little stick, twig, and I stuck it into the water vertically. And lo and behold, there was a little kind of wake or current or something that got formed in the edges of it. I said, oh, it actually is moving, it's not still. But I needed the reference point of the stick to see the current. So the breathing becomes the reference point to see the currents of our mind, what our minds are up to. And so we might see, for example, patterns of thinking and ideas and judgments and attitudes that maybe are somewhat invisible or we don't see how constant they are. It's not uncommon on these retreats for people to be surprised by the undercurrents of their mind, the common patterns. Probably if I was going to tally up what people tell me, the most common is people come and say, wow, I had no idea how afraid I am. Fear seems to underlie everything in me. Some people, they come and they say, wow, I have no idea how aversive I am. I'm critical of everything that happens. I never kind of speak, but you sit and have this reference point of coming back and going off and coming back. You start seeing what's going on. Oh, that's what's happening. That's what's happening. So it's not a matter of just staying on the breath and getting concentrated and blissful forever. In fact, if we could sit up here with your brilliant teachers and give you just exactly the instruction, that the perfect instruction, and you just knew, you follow that instruction, and those teachers would just give us the instruction that would just, the right instruction. There must be somewhere else that they can give us the right instruction. So we just sit down, do A, B, C, Boom! Bliss, emptiness, liberation. You know, none of this kind of messy stuff in my mind and my emotions and my history and my, life story and my aversions and my projections and these difficult people I have to practice with. Just no, they just follow. If we did that to you, it would do you a huge disservice. You wouldn't grow up. You wouldn't mature. You wouldn't discover how to be free. You wouldn't get to understand yourself inside and out. And so to encounter the truth is to see who we are, to see how we run and our patterns and our thoughts and our feelings. And to become a true person is someone who can honestly see, oh, this is what's happening. This is who I am. These are the experiences. This is it. This is what's happening. So it might not be whatever your thinking is. You don't have to be in a hurry to get back to the breath. As Adrian said, you can take a moment to recognize, oh, I'm thinking now. Recognize what you're thinking, just for a moment. And then maybe come back to breathing. And because of that act of recognition, something in you will remember. So you start to say, oh, after a while, there's a pattern here. It seems like most of my thoughts are about memory. I'm mostly rehearsing how I could have had a better conversation a week ago. Or maybe it's planning, or maybe it's fantasy. But to see, oh, this is what it is. And then the perfection of truth is to really be honest. This is what's happening here for me. Oh, it's like this. Mindfulness is a practice of truth-telling, of being honest with ourselves, recognizing and seeing what's here, and saying, oh, here it is. I'm upset. I'm sad. I'm calm. Oh, now I'm settled. And now that I'm settled, look at that. I'm thinking about how I can improve on it. Look at that. Improving thoughts. And then instead of doing that, let's come back to the breathing. Stay with the breath a little bit. And then there are thoughts of, this can't be all there is. Settled in the breathing. And then there's the recognition, the truth statement, the honesty. Oh, here's the mind being impatient or having doubt. And then there's something about that being honest, oh, this is what's happening, that maybe will create space or bring you back. Or you might recognize in that moment that's a contact with reality. It might not be your favorite reality to contact, but there it is. Oh, there's a thought. There's doubt. For a moment, I'm there with a doubt. I recognize it. I see it. If we get lost in the doubt, then we're not really touching it or contacting it. We're kind of submerged in it. But this idea of the truth, to recognize, to state, oh, this, to meet, what's real, what's happening now. And then as we see what's here, we see ourselves, the patient acceptance of that truth. As we see beyond the projections and ideas, patient acceptance of that which is beyond our usual concepts and ideas. Patient acceptance of sitting here without putting on the coat of self, without living with the ideas of who I should be or could be or would be, or just being here, sitting here quietly, patience, acceptance of being alive, maybe without needing to bring in the past, maybe without needing concerned about the future. And it can take some courage, this patience, acceptance of the truth, patience, acceptance of what's real, to be here with what's real. The real is always in the present moment. There's value in memories, there's value in thinking about the future, but the memories we think about, if we're thinking about the past, that's the thinking of the past is happening in the present. The thinking of the future is happening in the present. So the mindfulness connects to it as a real thing in a sense, real in the sense of, oh, this is an event of the present moment. The memories might not be accurate, the projection of the future might not be accurate, but there's a contact with reality. Oh, there's a thought. It's just a thought. Maybe there's a clear idea. Here I am, I'm thinking about the past. Right now, thinking about the past is happening. Is there some freedom to be found in that clear recognition? To see it as a statement of truth, a power of truth, to simply see, oh, I'm thinking about the past. Thinking about the past is happening. Thinking about the future is happening. Doesn't have to be different, doesn't have to be dragged down by thinking it should be different. Anytime we think it should be different, it's a projection. It's an idea that we laden, burden, or reality with. So the patience acceptance of the truth of what's real is a movement towards a certain kind of simplicity, a certain kind of subtleness, a certain kind of courage to just be here for this. There's actually a lot less we need to think about and figure out and analyze and engineer if we have a patient's acceptance of the truth of what's happening here now. Just this. And to have this simplicity of being is pretty precious. A sense of being here where it's clear that just to be alive is enough. For this moment at least, just to be alive is enough. To breathe, to sense, to feel. Maybe, just maybe, nothing more needs to happen this moment, but this moment as it is. This moment and mindful of this moment. And it's such a radical thing for the mind to be patient in this way, just or accepting in this way, where nothing needs to happen more than just awareness of this. That it's actually a pretty revolutionary act on the part of the mind to do this. Generally, the mind is practicing non-acceptance. Generally, the mind wants it different. It's trying to get something or analyze or figure or do something. Is unhappy with something or wants something or doesn't want something. And this thing, this way of being, where just to be alive is enough, nothing needs to happen, pulls the rug from underneath that part of the mind that is never content or always wants a difference, always afraid, always doing something. And it's not such a, I was going to say innocent, but it's not such a, it's not like an unimportant thing to do, to sit quietly and contentedly, doing nothing more than contentedly being with experience of this moment. It's not a minor thing to do if we can keep doing it. If we can hang with that for a while or come back to that. And it begins to dislodge some of the more painful, pain-producing ideations, ideas, projections, fantasies we have that we live in. The reactive mind that keeps us spinning. And it's a wonderful process then of coming home to just here, coming home to our good hearts. Not needing it to be different, except settling in and letting all the extra layers, to let them begin to slough off, fall off, fade away, weaken, soften. And maybe to have a sense of presence, a sense of awareness that becomes more important or more luminous or more, the simple presence is clearly of greater value than anything you can think about. And then your thoughts don't have to disappear. You don't have to stop thinking. But the thoughts can kind of recede to the periphery and not be that. The thoughts are no longer the home we live in, but rather the home that we live in is our presence, is in our hearts, here, the simplicity of just here. And the thoughts will take care of themselves, the great part. You don't have to give them that much attention. Stay close. Stay here. Make contact with reality. Be patient. Persist step by step. Do the best you can not to succumb to hostility towards yourself or others or the world or to reality. Forgive. Because without some forgiveness, it's hard to come home to the simplicity of just being here. And be honest. Be truthful. Whatever you see is happening in the present moment with yourself, not a mistake, it's just something to know. No amount of mindfulness is ever wasted. And whenever you have a chance, in the next moment, be mindful. And then do it again.